our speaker tonight. Stephen is a longtime practitioner and an ordained Soto Zen priest in the tradition of Suzuki Roshi, who's the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center and the Tassajara Zen Monastery in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Stephen was a professor for many years at the California Institute of Integral Studies in Psychology, and still has a private practice in psychology, as well as doing a lot of virtual Dharma nowadays. So Stephen, welcome. Unmute yourself.
Talk might be better if I didn't. Thank you, Carl. It's a pleasure to be here with everyone. I want to share a little poem that I heard the other day. Whether in daytime or in nighttime, I always carry inside a light. In the middle of noise and turmoil, I carry silence. Always, I carry light and silence. Was pleased to be reminded of that poem. It's by a woman named Anna Swer, and I heard it on the other day. So I was thinking about, you know, we're in this beautiful season where the days are getting shorter and the nights longer, and it's darkness, and you know, it has all sorts of impacts on people. And one of the impacts that it has, I'm on the sixth floor of a building in West Portal looking out over the neighborhood. And one of the impacts that it has is that there are twinkly lights on lots of houses in my neighborhood. Right across the street from me, there's a house that looks like Santa Claus exploded there. And right across the street from that is a house with a big, beautiful 4-foot menorah on the top of it. And so I'm reminded that although the world gives us darkness at a certain time of the year, and, you know, starting in November, October, November, going through December and all the way in through early spring. So there'd be this long period of darkness. And what's happened over time is that many faith traditions and cultural traditions have established holidays. As Buddhists, we celebrate the enlightenment of the Buddha on the 8th of December. Hanukkah started on the 10th of December. Christmas will be on the 26th, Kwanzaa's on the 8th. Many people celebrate the winter solstice. And the thing that all of these holidays have in common, they have many things in common, but one of the things for me that they have in common is that they all involve light and lights and sparkly lights and candles and fire and all manner of light. And it just reminds me that, you know, as human beings, the world simply provides us with situations and presents us with things that we must live with. The darkness just happens at a certain time of the year. And so we as human beings get to then respond. We get to determine what we can arouse within us or external to us, but what we can arouse to meet whatever comes up. And so at the time of the year when it's dark, people decided that they would have festivals of light. And so that's a really wonderful way of thinking about the life that we're all living right now. You know, 2020 with all the stuff that it's brought. And the fact of the matter is that those of us on this call, in this meeting, have survived 2020 up until the 14th of December. So we made it. We somehow came together with our individual strength and our collective strength and have arrived at this point where there is some reasons to be hopeful and some reasons to believe that things may are in the process of improving. And that at that same time, as spiritual people and as compassionate people, we pause. Because today the number of folks who have passed away from COVID went over 300,000. So we take a second to honor each of them and their families, to bring to mind all of the first responders, be they grocery store clerks or janitors, nurses, doctors, all of the folks who on a day-to-day basis have had to deal in a way that I haven't, and some of you haven't had to deal with that 300,000 number. But as human beings, you know, I think the last time, wasn't published yet, I don't think the last time I was here, maybe I was, showed it to you. Time magazine last week had a cover that said 2020, and the headline for the year was the worst year ever. And it dawned on me that probably it was not the worst year ever, that I'm not sure what that might have been, but you know, certainly was a year, but we have ways of finding to bring the light to the darkness, basically. And I think that's really important. And so as I was thinking about it, I was looking for a book on my shelf of many, many Buddhist books, a result of my deep study a little bit and my addiction to Amazon Prime a lot. So I have shelves full of books that I can sometimes find and sometimes not. But I was looking for one and instead found another one, which is called Branching Streams Flow in the Darkness. It's a series of talks given by Suzuki Roshi, who Carl mentioned, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center. And it's about a beautiful poem that was written by Sekito Kizan 1200 years ago. And then it was translated for Soto Zen folks by the official school of Soto Zen just in 1997. So it was hidden for many years. And the poem is called Sendokai. And the translation that was developed in the Soto Zen school in 1997 at a conference, a worldwide conference that actually was held at Green Gulch Farm up in Marin County. And the translation is called The Harmony of Difference and Equality. And it's recited in Zen centers all over, the Soto Zen centers all over the world every day. Many, many places recited every day. So I've been reading it for about 10 days now. And I take it with me when I go on my, as some of you know that have listened to me talk before, I go to the beach every day, or 5 or 6 days a week at least, to that's where I do my meditations. And if anybody wants to go for a walk, just let me know, we can meditate together. But on Saturday morning, I almost never go to the Zen talks on Saturday morning, just due to scheduling and stuff. But I went to the talk on Saturday morning, first time in about 2.5 years. And Paul Haller, one of the teachers there, was giving a talk, and his talk was on the Sendokai. And so thank you, Paul, for further inspiration. And he's the one who mentioned that first poem, that there is a light. And so Sendokai basically is, as I say, the translation is the harmony and equality. And so it becomes harmony of difference and equality, excuse me. And really what it's about is paradox and how we live in a world where we are accustomed to black and white thinking or up and down thinking, man, male, female, transgender, gender fluid. We live in a world where we make judgments and we will make reflections all the time. And yet we know that we live in an absolute world where from November to late March, it's gonna be dark. And so there's what we know, and then there's what the world has to offer. And so I wanna read you just a little bit of the poem, and it's just one page. Actually, I'll probably read the whole thing just because I think it's certainly the words, 1200-year-old words are as valuable as what I will offer in addition to them. So just listen to the words, and I can send it to everybody, or you can certainly download it later if you wanna have a longer time to think about it. Harmony of difference and equality. The mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from east to west. While human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. The spiritual source shines clear in the light. The branching streams flow out in the dark. Grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. All the objects of the senses interact, and yet they do not. Interacting brings involvement. Otherwise, each keeps its place. Sights vary in quality and form. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. Refined and common speech come together in the dark. Clear and murky phrases are distinguished in the light. The four elements return to their natures just as a child turns to its mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, and the earth is solid. Eyes and sights, ears and sound, nose and smells, tongue and taste. Thus, with each and everything, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. Trunk and branches share the essence. Revered and common, each has its speech. In the light, there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark, there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark oppose one another like the front and back foot in walking. Each of the myriad things has its merit, expressed according to function and place. Phenomena exist, box and lid fit. Principle responds, arrow points meet. Hearing the words, understand the meaning. Don't set up standards of your own. If you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? Progress is not a matter of far or near, but if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. I respectfully urge you who study this mystery, do not pass your days and nights in vain. So it's a beautiful poem. It's 1200 years old. And I think there's just some wonderful things in there for us as we're practicing in 2020. What it talks about is, as I say, it's paradox that the Buddha mind includes everything. And we all have Buddha mind. Each one of us has Buddha mind. And that's our capacity that we have to see things as they are. And when we sit meditation, as we just did for half an hour, the idea is to just sit and really allow ourselves to be present in this moment, not reflecting on what just happened or what will happen next, not doing any of those things, but simply in those moments. And sometimes we say, well, that's just like taking a break from real life, or that's you're abandoning the need to be diligent in the fight against poverty or child hunger or racism or other things that we must be involved in, and what a privileged luxury it is to be able to sit and be for 30 minutes or however long we sit in our daily lives. But you know, we don't really sit for that reason. We sit to be fully present in the moment. We sit not to think about whether we're sitting right or sitting wrong. We sit so that we have that opportunity to say, this is who I am. This is who I am. So the conversations I was having just before I got here, that was me in conversation with other people, hopefully trying to be understanding and compassionate, possibly trying to win the argument, make the best point, say something, whatever. So we won't get rid of our behaviors and we won't get rid of our capacities to behave that way. But in that time that we're sitting, in that meditation, that we practice with as a way of then being present in the rest of the world, we work with those behaviors. We get a chance to say, who am I before I got into that discussion? Who am I after that discussion? Am I the kind of person in those discussions or in my work or in my relationships that I want to be? You know, we all have desires, and there's nothing wrong with desires. They're wonderful, desires of the flesh, desires of the mind. And again, as Buddhists, we don't pretend to get rid of desires, whatever they might be for. In fact, the very nature of our Buddhist practice is to observe them and to observe them not judgmentally. I've been a Buddhist for 28 years. I can't believe I'm still wanting to win every argument. Or I've been a Buddhist for 3 days or however long it might be for you. And I can't believe I'm still dealing with, my desires for food or drink or sex or whatever it might be. In fact, what we do in meditation is we get back to our original nature, to our original self, and say, and so these things come up. What can I arouse within myself to meet those desires, to meet those behaviors, to meet those thoughts in a way that really makes sense? In that book, Suzuki Roshi tells a little story that, and mind you, this was written 30 years ago. If you're a computer, you need all the data. How much desire do you have? How much anger do you have? How much nourishment do you need? How much internal strength do you have? How much external support do you have? We include our desires as one of the many factors in our capacity and skill at living with things exactly as they are. This is the very essence of our practice. Being aware to all factors and then realize that one and many inter are. So our desires and our spiritual life, our anger and our meditation. All of that factors in. And so they're all different pieces that make up the whole of us. So that becomes really important. Me and my desires, me and all my behaviors, me and my quiet moments of meditation, this is the mind that I take out into the world. Later in the poem, there are some other verses that I find really wonderful. The spiritual source shines clear in the night, branching streams flow in the dark, grasping at things is surely delusion, according with sameness is still not enlightenment. And so it's not about thinking. It's not about grasping at, I was really kind and compassionate yesterday. Let me hang on to that. I want to be that guy every day. Or a friend suffered a tremendous loss and I was able to be there for that person. And so those are good things to do, but grasping onto them as an identity is where it becomes problematic. Because if I'm saying, oh, I was a really good person yesterday, let me continue to do that. What it probably means is that in the rest of my mind, I'm thinking, because I wasn't such a good guy on Friday or the day before that. And the fact that I was a really good guy yesterday doesn't mean that I've achieved some sort of enlightenment or awokeness or awakening. Suzuki Roshi famously said that awakening is an accident, but practice makes you accident prone. So it's all about the practice and continuing the practice. Later it says, just one more verse for us. Practice is not a matter of far or near, but if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. I respectfully urge you to study the mystery. Do not pass your days or nights in vain. And so I just want to read you what Suzuki Roshi says about that. Practice is not a matter of far or near. This is very important. When you are involved in selfish practice, you have some idea of attainment. When you strive to reach the goal or attain enlightenment, you naturally have ideas. I am far from the goal, or I'm almost there. But if you really practice that way, enlightenment is right where you are. If you really practice our way, enlightenment is right where you are. This may be rather difficult to accept. When you practice Zazen without any idea of attainment, there is actually enlightenment. That is the enlightenment. And later he says, it's a big mistake to think that the best way to express yourself is to do whatever you want, acting however you please. This is not expressing yourself. When you have many possible ways of expressing yourself, you are not sure what to do. So you will behave superficially. If you know what to do exactly and you do it, you can express yourself fully. And so it's just this beautiful idea in this poem. And I really hope you get a chance to download it or read it. And some of you probably have read it lots of times and maybe just reflect on it as we're in this season of dark and light. Because I think it really just gives us this opportunity to say, you know, we have this opportunity to sit in Zazen, to be on the Buddha's path, which is the path of just being who we originally were. And when we're on that path and when we're in that mode, we call that right view. When I view the world as from my original nature, which is for each one of us, Buddha nature. And that means that we are created with compassion and kindness. We're created with concern for one another and the capacity to be fully present for each other. And so that's the view that we carry into the world, and we sit so that we can get back to that, so that we're not caught up in the rush of the world in terms of what we have to think and do and say and to get through day to day and do the things that we need to do. Then when we have that right view that we want to be kind and compassionate and connected, then we set the intention to do that. And that's how we're going to go into the world. We decide what we're going to do for work, how we're going to treat friends, what conversations we're going to have and not going to have with relatives at the holidays, et cetera. And that's the intention, to live the way our original nature tells us to. And each of you has that original nature. And then we follow that up with right speech and right action and right effort. And that the way Paul explained it on Saturday, which I found really, really helpful, is that we spend an awful lot of our time doing. And, you know, doing this and doing that, especially at holiday season with work and all the necessity of online shopping, et cetera. We're all just really quite busy. And that what our spiritual practice invites us to do is to be rather than to do. So there are things we have to do and we will, but if the foundation for every day that we are alive is to say, who am I? What kind of person am I? And how can I carry that kind of person, that person who has fears and who has angers and frustrations, but who also has possibility and joy and kindness, and who knows that he can arouse or she can arouse or they can arouse from within themselves what they need to face the day. And when they can't arouse what's within themselves, they know that they can turn to their left or their right and ask for resources from the Sangha, from your friends, from your family. And so that becomes a really important factor in our interbeing. And that interbeing is how we relate to and connect to one another. And so there's a wonderful old poem by Gunilla Norris, and it says, it's a paradox that we encounter so much internal noise when we first try to sit in silence. It's a paradox that experiencing pain releases pain. It's a paradox that keeping still can lead us so fully into life and being. Our minds do not like paradoxes. We want things to be clear so we can maintain our illusion of safety. Certainty breeds tremendous smugness. We each possess a deeper level of being, however, which loves paradox. It knows that summer is already growing like a seed in the depths of winter. It knows that the moment we are born, we begin to die. It knows that all of life shimmers, its shadows of becoming, the shadow of light, the shadow and light are always together, the visible mingling with the invisible. When we sit in silence, we are profoundly active. Keeping silence, we hear the roar of existence. Through our willingness to be one, the one we are, through our willingness to be the one we are, we become one with everything. And so I think during this season of darkness, let's take a look around and see the ways that faith communities and cultural communities throughout history have responded to the phenomena of darkness by creating festivals of light, and who have responded to the colder weather leading everybody indoors to celebrations where people gather. And let us, even in 2020 with shelter in place, let's remember that we have this Sangha every Monday night, and that it is beautiful in and of itself. And it's a metaphor for the capacity we have for Zazen, for meditation practice, and for interconnection between all of us. And so let us greet the darkness and the possibility of isolation with our own festival of lights and our own both beautiful solitude and deep and rich interconnection. Thanks, everybody.
Stephen, thank you for that uplifting talk, and lots to contemplate during this dark time, as you said, with plenty of light and a lot to be grateful for in the midst of all the difficulty.